Action Park Media.
Just like music.
All right, welcome to another episode of Victory the Podcast. I'm Doug Ellen.
And I am Kevin Connolly. We have a special episode of Victory the Podcast. Special guest, Doug, that you want to...
I'll introduce him, but we are missing Kevin Dillon.
Of course. He's not a two-day-a-week guy.
Yeah, if we're going to do two a week, Kevin Dillon cannot make it from Malibu, twice a week.
Because the traffic is just difficult. So terrible in the middle of the day. So maybe Jordan can get him a helicopter.
Yeah, so to introduce our great, fascinating guest, Connolly and I both grew up on Long Island, New York, and we grew up with a lot of maniacs.
Right.
I mean, it's just that simple. And Jordan, who's from Queens, correct?
Yeah. Queens.
So Jordan is from Queens. Jordan Belfort, Wolf of Wall Street, but is someone I know 20 years and grew up with one of his best friends. And anyway, welcome.
You knew him pre-Wolf of Wall Street.
You know what? The tragedy, Jordan, can tell you. Jordan, and we're going to get into the fact that Jordan really is. Why is he a great salesman? He pushed that fucking movie through, and Jordan gave me the book. I'm not saying that, A, because Connolly likes the... Jordan, Connolly likes...
Do you think you could have done a better job than Scorsese?
I definitely could not have, and you could not have done a better job than Leo.
This is true.
But Jordan gave me the book years before anyone had the book, and I'm a dumb motherfucker because I could have maybe given it to Scorsese and said, could I have some part of this? Could I just like...
Well, you would have been an executive producer
anything.
Or something.
Anything. Right. I would have been on the set at least. Anyway, welcome, Jordan Belfort.
Hindsight's 2020, though, right? You could say how many movies, I think what Rocky got passed on 100 times, right? I mean, it's just the way it is. And I think that the things that you said, though, are true. I mean, like you looked at the book from one perspective, which is like, wow. Like, and at that moment, I believe it was pre-2008. That you saw it so early, it was before the financial meltdown. I think before that, I seemed like kind of like, oh my God, he was such a terrible guy. And then it was like, wait a second. There was a lot worse going on than that. And it started to sort of all make sense in context. And at the same time, I think there's Scorsese can get things pushed through, especially Leo and Scorsese, that would never have gotten produced by a big studio with all the cursing and the sex.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. I know you're interviewing me, but do you think that movie could get made today?
Only with Leo and Scorsese.
Right.
It ain't getting made with Connolly and me. Let's
right.
put it that way.
Well, also, too, Jordan, that brings me to my most important question. And I'm going to ask this question for Doug.
Sure.
So obviously there's the PC culture and things have changed. I mean, that's common knowledge. I guess the question is for Doug, and I think it's a fair question. With Leo and Scorsese, it's art, and then Entourage is misogyny or whatever the word. So is it Scorsese and Leo that
Well,
that
I want to jump in before Jordan answers that. Good question. But I want to say I saw Wolf of Wall Street with Jordan and with our mutual good friend who sadly has passed away, Barry. And I saw it probably 7 months before it was released or
right.
whatever. And what I remember is because I was pushed to make the movie R. They wanted an R-rated comedy. That was the hot thing at the time. So, you know, I put a little things in. And I was feeling a little bit like, oh, I hope people don't think it's a little this, little that. And then I saw Wolf of Wall Street, which, just so we're all clear, I love the movie. Absolutely love it. I wish I
you
could.
You did love it.
Love it. It was some of the funniest shit I've ever seen, which is what I did miss when I read the book. I grew up with all that stuff. I know how funny it was. I didn't think other people would think it was funny. Anyway, my point was, I saw the movie. And I said, Entourage is fucking tame. Are you kidding me? But there is crossover, no matter what anyone wants to say. So anyway, our guest will now speak.
I'll speak. All right. There's a big difference I think you guys are missing here. The Wolf of Wall Street is a period piece. It takes place in the 80s and 90s. That's like saying you could look at Mad and say, how could you glamorize the abuse of women, treating women like that and then objectifying them? But in the context of the 1950s, everyone could look back and say, oh my God, wow. And it's more of a learning experience versus like when people look at an Entourage, they'll say, and even though I know you're not like that, you respect women, you're not meant to glorify, you're just showing your, and by the way, it is almost a period piece in some respect. It's probably pre Me Too Hollywood. And I think though that Wolf gets somewhat of an exemption because it happened in 25 years ago. So people can look back at it and feel safe that it's not happening right now and they can laugh and feel good about it.
That's fair.
Yeah. And again, for me, the PC bullshit is nonsense. The movie is what it is. And
exactly.
It's great. But what was shocking to me about the movie, which Goodfellas was a classic morality tale. You do bad shit, you suffer bad consequences. Ultimately, you and your friends all end up dead or in jail. Wolf of Wall Street, what I thought the most genius thing about it was, is that it was speaking to what America is, that you can get away with all the excesses if you can live with yourself and you can come back. And Jordan, you've done that, which, you know, and I'm not comparing you to any of the stuff Henry Hill was doing in Goodfellas, of course.
Right.
But you've made this remarkable comeback and turned, you know, a lot of people have movies made about their lives and they don't end up branding themselves the way you have, build a business and come back stronger than you ever were, doing it legally now, all. So what was your, like, what was your plan? Did you think when the movie was getting made that you started thinking about that design of?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a good question. And I'd be lying to you to say that I had planned this whole thing out before it happened. You know, what happens, I think, as a business person, no matter what you're doing, it's branding yourself, whether it's just growing a business, start on an idea, you're constantly reacting to what's happening around you and pivoting and trying something again and not being let down or set back or becoming negative when things don't work out. Because I think you can look at where I am now and it all looks really good. But if you go back to the beginning, you know, when I first released the book and then all these things that I had to do along the way, like, for example, when the book first came out, there was no redemption story yet. It was just the book, and it was this wild thing, and a lot of journalists would trash me, and every single article was just negative, and rightfully so, but, like, I had to take it on the chin. And even though in my heart, I'm like, but I'm out there doing the right thing right now. I'm training people. I'm empowering people. I'm a nice – and but you know what? People saying, prove it. Well, it's been now 13 years, and in those 13 years, I've helped millions of people, and I think people have finally, over the last 4 or 5, said, wow, I guess if that's just like, you know, 10 years straight, I guess that's what he is now, and eventually the story changes. But you need to have a very thick skin, as you all know,
yep,
in the process, because there are some really vicious, not just journalists out there, but people online, and no matter what you do, if you were Jesus Christ, and they said, I'm not saying I am, but they, and you gave the sermon on the Temple Mount, they'd say, oh, what an idiot. What a loser that is. Like, that, there's nothing new there. Like,
it's a bad speech.
terrible speech, right? No, so who wants to hear from him? So I think what you need to do in terms of, you know, branding yourself and just coming back from failure or just coming back from just the pandemic is that you can't ever accept the way things are as the status quo. You can't ever rest on your laurels. It's constantly looking around you and saying, how do I make the most out of the opportunities as they are today without whining or crying about how I wish it was different? That's the big one.
And I think that's what I saw from you from the beginning. You had, and listen, I'm like most people, salesmen as a rule, kind of you go, fucking A, leave me alone, get away from me, this and that. You were always persuasive in a way that made me listen to what you said.
Obviously.
No, but still, what I was bringing this to is Connolly's a tough sell. So I remember when you were on the, Jordan was on the Entourage set and he's got the book and he's trying to attach Leo, who I need to remember, did Leo read the script?
He was attached, but he was attached to how many things?
He's attached to 8,000 things,
right? Yeah.
So Connolly's best friends with Leo. Jordan is going to sell and he's going to get Scorsese and Leo. And I believe that was a big part of it. I do. I believe the fact.
Of course.
If Jordan just wrote the book and threw it out there, that movie's not getting made like that. Jordan had a big hand. So what happens? You come onto the set. You're like, you know, Connolly's
can
got
I
this.
Tell, yeah, let yeah. me tell the story. So, you know, for people listening out there, by the end, season 7, 8 of Entourage was like doing live television. Yeah, between takes, everybody's, there's a million, there was. I mean, there was just rows.
I would
rows.
Bring a lot of friends
huge,
there.
But not just you, but a lot of people were there. It was big. It was a fun set to visit. So people were there. So Jordan is probably 2 or 3 rows behind me. And I was looking at something in the monitor, whatever, we're going over something. I was directing the episode. So I was looking at something at playback and Jordan is very sitting there minding his own business a couple rows back. And he's like, hey, Kevin, so you think Leo's going to do my movie? And I just said, probably not. Now, the reason I said that wasn't because of The Wolf of Wall Street or the book or the subject matter. The statistic probability
is so small
of getting Leo and Scorsese on a movie set to do $100 million movie that nobody wants to make. It's just near impossible.
And that
so
is
it wasn't
my point.
A reflection on Jordan.
Of
it
course
was a reflection
not.
On it's just a needle in a haystack.
And my point, the reflection on Jordan that I see is where that, if it was me, that might have just shot me down and be like, oh, Jordan used it and went, I'm moving forward and nobody's stopping me.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, I have to say a couple things. Number one, Leo was the one that drove this project forward. Seriously, Leo. Leo read this, loved it, was attached to it. And he said to me from the very beginning, I want you to know that this is not the typical project I attached to. It's my passion project. We're going to get this made. Have faith in me. And he kept his word to me the entire time. In addition to that, there was other people. I know Rick Yorn's a controversial character and people, like, you know, could hate him or love him. But Rick Yorn also worked really, really hard. And in the end, pulled through. I had my own manager, Scott Lambert. I had Alexandra Milchin. I had those people around me.
Everybody that you just mentioned are some serious fucking heavy hitters.
These are the right. These people are really
it
get
doesn't get
done.
Any heavier than that.
And the point is, they all, we had our battles along the way, Rick and I. But at the end of the day, you know, they all came through. And my role in it was just basically to, A, not screw up my life in the process, by the way.
Right.
And also, one thing that was crucial is I actually made the movie a better movie by coming back from what had happened. So by the time the movie get made, it gave Marty and Terry Winter and Leo the ability to rewrite the last act, because the movie originally ended with me in jail.
It didn't have a redemption.
No. It was, I went to jail. And then over that 6 or 7 year lag until
which
the movie
is
got
crazy.
Made,
so just so people are listening, you're a filmmaker out there. This is Leo and Scorsese, and it took 6 years with the two of unquestionably the biggest in the business, maybe ever, to 6 or 7
it's
years to get a movie.
Very difficult. And it was mostly Scorsese because it just takes him longer. He can't move from project to project. Like Leo is an actor. He does something and I guess he could do 2 a year, like if he wanted to, but Marty will live with it for like it's a 2 or 3 year thing, right? Big difference.
Also too, I mean, it's a 6 month prep. It's
exactly.
A 4 month shoot. And then a year of, you can, as a director on that level, you can only do one movie every couple years.
Exactly. So what happened was, is I had this major comeback and built a business without the movie. And then when Leo called me, he was, hey, we're ready to make the movie. And he came to my house. He's like, wait a second, you're living in a huge house on the water. He went, what happened? And I'm like, oh, I'm just, you know, out there in this, go around the world to give speeches. I train people. He's like, show me. I showed him a video. He's like, oh my God, wait till Marty sees this. He's going to go crazy. So he sent it to Marty, who fell in love with the whole idea. They rewrote the third act. Terry did with as well. And it just, they made it a much better movie. Because as you said, I think what people really like about it is that, you know, it's this sort of comeback story. And it also, it rings true. True in the sense that, for example, they were looking for an ending to the movie, like an actual ending, the last scene. And I was like, well, you know, at the time I was doing some charity work in Africa. I said, how about if it's I'm doing charity work? He goes, really? Is that really the Wolf of Wall Street with people? The truth is, the wolf is still selling,
right,
and he teaches others now, but he does it the right way. That's truly what America is. And I think that's why when people look at it, also in Scorsese's genius, is that he doesn't moralize when he makes a movie. Like, he puts characters on a screen and doesn't tell you how you should feel. They could have me murdering a small cat. And like, oh, you hate the guy. So you could do things in a movie that instantly make you hate a character or love a character. So Marty has a way of doing it where it's just like, you put it up there as real life is, it rings true, and people judge based on their own beliefs and experiences. That's why I think people love the movie.
So how much interaction, because, you know, we had Scorsese, obviously, was on Entourage.
I thought you were going to say we had Scorsese on the podcast. I was going to go, Doug, am I supposed to play along with you on this?
Well, we're gonna do what Jordan did to you. Jordan, you think we'll get Scorsese on the podcast?
Yeah, probably not.
It's a tough one. So, you know, obviously, when Scorsese was on the show, this is my fucking hero. I mean, this is a guy I fucking idolize. Every single one of his movies I've seen a dozen times. I'm not joking, including Silence, including everything. So,
including Silence.
I did, and I loved it, by the way. I swear to God, I loved it. So my point was, though, when he came on, it was intimidating. It was that presence. I didn't want to bother him, even though he was working for me for a minute.
Nicest guy ever, right?
He couldn't have been nicer. My point was, how much interaction did you have with him? One. And two, was he going, I see this as a comedy?
Okay, so.
Great question.
My interactions with Scorsese were limited for this particular reason. Early on we spoke, and he's like, listen, get this. I love this story. You need to trust me with the character that I think people want to see and what this needs to be. And if I try to get you involved in every scene and you're advising me, the idealized version that I have is going to get confused with what you think it should be. So you need to trust me and let me be clear. And that made perfect sense to me. So I literally backed off, and Leo and I worked together almost daily. So I was like sort of constantly helping Leo. We were going through literally every word, every line in the script, trying to make it more authentic and better. I mean, don't get me wrong, Terry just knocked it out of the park, but just, you know, just that little last bit. And he was the liaison to Scorsese. And then I did go on the set. I met Marty, and he could not have been nicer and more generous. And listen, what can I say? I mean, they made a movie that in some way is a commercial for my business, ended with me on stage in an iconic scene with Sell Me This Pen. So I was very fortunate and smart to have trusted Scorsese with my life story, you know?
It's funny. There's the famous story about Bradley Cooper with American Sniper. I believe the guy was Chris Kyle, or I'm butchering his name, the sniper. This guy and Bradley Cooper were out trying to make that movie for a while, and they couldn't get the movie made until he got killed by a rogue veteran.
At a gun range,
but on a much darker, you know, obviously a much darker example. Okay, and that's, now we have an ending to our movie. Whereas, obviously, Wolf of Wall Street was a little more uplifting, but American Sniper, who Clint Eastwood, I mean, not Oscars around the horn, couldn't get made until he got killed.
It always causes, you know, it's always a difficult journey. Yeah.
Give you the perfect Entourage example here. It's the same way that Vince did not want anyone to see the cut of the movie that he made. He was scared until it was absolutely perfect, and he ran away, did it, right? Yeah. What was the movie again?
Hide,
right? So he didn't want anyone, but the point is like, I was laughing my ass off, because like, in some of, like, Marty was like, just like, like, as amazing as he is, I'm probably as insecure as he is as a director.
Yeah.
Because he's so, you know, he's so conscious of his art, and he wants it to be perfect. So the idea that the real person is saying, no, it's not that way, it would have driven him up the wall.
Right.
Even the thought of having me there looking at, saying, with narrowed eyes. So I totally got that. But I never felt like for a second that I wasn't intimately involved, because every day Leo and I were constantly working on
that. Well, that was the other thing I want to talk about, because when I saw the movie with you, and I know Leo a little bit. He likes to call me the fucking producer all the time when I see him with Connelly. But I was blown away. He was you. And while it seems like, okay, so he's just playing this kind of Queens guy, he really was walking like you, carrying himself like you. Did he discuss that with you, or he just observed you?
No. We went through things in a very formulaic way and observational. But I'll tell you something really funny. So recently, in the last few days, I released a video that was a funny mashup of the movie and me doing a scene that I actually had done in real life. And I think you guys probably saw that.
I saw it.
It was really funny. And half of the, and Leo Colby goes, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. And like, there's two sides of comments we're getting, both of us. Wow, you do the best to me. You're the best Leonardo DiCaprio imitation ever. And oh my God, how talented is Leo that he was able to get you like that? So for me, I'll just tell you flat out, I'm the worst actor in the world. That was not me acting. That was me being me. It was really easy for me to do that scene because it was me, right? People say, well, you weren't as good as Leo. Well, number one, that was one take. But also, by the way, Leo is like the world's greatest actor, basically. Right. So like, but, and, you know, and I think also I was actually pretty proud that I was able to recreate the energy in the moment. It's really weird. You're looking into a camera, and I was in my bathroom, by the way. In my bathroom in front of a white shade. And the guy who works for me, the video guy, just did a really good job intercutting it with the movie. And but it's really funny. People said, wow, you do a great DiCaprio imitation.
Well, check this video out on Jordan's Instagram. It's great. But I think you got the acting bug. And the thing is, listen, from me knowing you and growing up with you, and the same thing, I'll say Goodfellas, gangsters, salesmen, they're the funniest people in the world. We know that. And that's why, to me, comedy influences me. No one really understands this when I say Goodfellas was like a comedy influence on me. Sopranos has some of the funniest shit I've ever seen in my life. And Raging Bull, even. And Wolf of Wall Street, it really, I don't think I've laughed that hard
in
my life.
Doug, you and I talked about the Quaalude scene is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in any movie anywhere. Because it's this hard R. But it's like Bridesmaids funny.
Yeah.
Can I tell you guys something?
I want to tell you guys something. Someone called me up the other day saying they had 10 real Quaaludes. And they said they were in the bottle still. And they're
what's
like,
that worth?
So they said, do you want to
not real.
Do you want to buy them? I'm like, yeah. I mean, like, so like,
just to have
how much?
Them.
I said, 500. I'll take them all. Right. And I haven't seen them yet. But, and they're swearing. So I doubt it.
So you'll know this. So Barry Gesser is Jordan and I's mutual friend, one of my best friends who passed away. He's as crazy as Jordan.
And he's the guys, you guys know each other through Barry, who's passed away.
Yes, correct.
So Barry was my neighbor, but
I loved Barry.
Just a quick Kevin Connolly story. This is how crazy Barry was and really was one of the role models for Vince when I started the show. But Connolly came over to Barry's house one day and just said, hey, Barry, that Bentley.
No, I said, that's my ultimate one day. That's like the car. That's my dream car.
A Bentley.
That car. It's the hatchback, yeah.
But Connolly goes, would I look like a jerk off driving around in this car? And Barry goes, why don't you just take it and see? They just met and you had it for months.
Yeah, I mean, I felt uncomfortable taking driving out of there in a Bentley. It was weird because you picked me up. And like an hour later, there I am on Sunset Boulevard driving this Bentley. And then eventually I said, yeah, I do look like a jerk off. I do look like a jerk off. And then I called Doug. I'm like, Doug, you got to tell Barry I got to give him this call back.
Which so Barry would be insulted by.
He gave me a Bentley.
I know. That's
so
Barry.
So just getting back to that Quayle thing. So about 3 years ago, I can't mention any names, but a big manager in Hollywood, whose wife I know, calls me up and says, I have a billionaire friend in Chicago. They made new Quaaludes. So I call Barry. This is 5 years ago. I go, Barry, you're not going to believe this.
He said, no way, right?
No, Barry goes, I want 10,000. Okay. The next thing I know, we're driving to Malibu, which Kevin Dillon, we got there quickly. Yeah. We got there quickly.
Took you 20 minutes.
We go to Malibu and this woman is we're basically making a drug deal and her husband.
No,
comes,
you're not basically making a drug deal.
You're making a drug deal.
You're making a drug deal.
We're making a drug deal. So her husband comes down. He fucking freaks out. I mean, he's like, can't believe his wife is doing this. We walk out with like a bag full of pills. We go to Montana, actually. We take them.
Took them across state lines.
They were fucking horse tranquilizers. We were out cold. So, but the stories that I heard, and I had one night on Quaaludes in my life before they were outlawed, and it was the greatest drug. If you did it normally, if you drank and did Quaaludes, everybody knew what could happen. So, Jordan, why were you doing that? Quaaludes and alcohol as a mixture is a
very
recipe
dangerous
for black.
Kathleen Ann Quinlan, remember her from the 70s, who blacked out and died on the Quaaludes?
Yep.
Why was I doing Quaaludes?
And drinking.
Well, I wasn't a huge drinker, to tell you the truth. It was a mild drinker. We would use alcohol, typically hot sake, as an accelerant, like, you know, to dissolve the pills. It's like gasoline in a raging fire sort of thing, right? Made
like
sense at the time, right? You know, I always see like on these pills you get from the drugstore, they say, you know, alcohol will intensify this effect. I'm like, so that means to drink heavily, basically. right, yeah. So Quaaludes were fucking awesome. They were just like so, it's hard to explain because all the kids, they have different stuff now. It was this incredibly clean, euphoric high that, as you pointed out, had little consequence until you went over the line, and then there was massive consequences. So,
I feel so left out.
I know. It was an amazing thing. I remember it was so prevalent that it was probably the single most abused prescription drug in terms of the ratio of real prescriptions to phony. Like, with the opioid crisis, there are legitimate uses for opioids. There are.
This is not for Quaaludes.
There's not. No, there was no fucking no use. There's like no use for a Quaalude other than to get high with, basically.
Right.
The worst sleeping pill. They just like, they made you feel great, you know?
Well, let me ask you this. Was it socially, for example, you know, nowadays anybody can smoke weed wherever you want. Edibles. Doug has got a horrible edible problem. All day long he's stoned. It's socially acceptable where, you know, if all of a sudden Doug left the studio and like was in the bathroom snorting cocaine, I'd be like, dude, what the fuck is wrong with Doug? Were Quaaludes socially acceptable, or was it like, this guy's out of his mind on Quaaludes?
It was still the latter, because Quaaludes, so people like snorting coke in the bathroom in the 80s was socially acceptable,
right?
By the way, that was. Quaaludes were a nighttime drug. They were not a daytime drug. At least they were not supposed to be, because you'd get sloppy. It was part of the fun. You'd get a bit sloppy. Even if you didn't go over the line, you'd still be a little bit like a loo there, rounding out your vowels.
Saying some weird. That sounded weird. What do you say?
Exactly. Right. So like, there was this unbelievable experience that we all would get. Every drug addict has had this, where you get to this perfect state of toxic poise, where you're like, you have the right mixture of drugs in your system. It's like, right, ups and downs. It's so fleeting, so hard to get to. The problem is, once you get it, you spend that 10 years chasing that moment again, and you can never really,
which you don't even know, if it was real anyway. But
well, it was mostly imagined. But like, the point is that you would like take Ludes and get this hard to explain euphoria that would be like 15 to 30 minutes long. And then you would try to keep that going by popping a second one.
Smoke
and so
a little
on.
Weed, maybe do a shot.
Maybe.
And I can explain a Quaalude, one Quaalude on its own is very simply like, to me, it was drinking a dozen beers
yes.
with no side effects.
Correct. Wow.
Life was great.
Yeah.
Everybody looked better. You felt good about yourself, and it was if you could not cross that line where you wreck a Ferrari.
I got to get my hands on some.
You'll never get them.
And also, though, you know, as you learned the hard way with these bootlegs, as we called them, they're all different types of Quaaludes. You might have the right Quaalude mixture, which is methaqualone, but it's how it was buffered, how it's released into your system. There were different brands. Some brands would make you really sleepy, and other brands would give you that euphoric feeling. And of all the different brands, it was like the lemons that got it best. They got
oh,
it
that's,
right.
That's what it was called, the lemons?
Lemon
so
714.
If you were like, I got Quaaludes, I got lemons. It was like game
lemons and Roarers were the two top ones. Then you had others that were heavier, like you had Methacetals, and you had Paladin Burmas and Toquilones and all these different brands from different Jesus. Around the world. And they were sometimes even mixed with things like diphenhydramine, which is the stuff that you find in sleeping pills. It's like Benadryl, basically, right? They mix it with that stuff. That's terrible. That would make you more sloppy and tired. But when you got it right, it was amazing. Thank God they're illegal. I mean, thank God they're not.
So
around.
It's better that it's illegal.
Oh my God,
they
should.
The whole world would be
around.
Fine.
The whole. It's better for everyone. I'm so happy I can't get one. Like I don't want one. I want one if you have.
By
one.
The way, Jordan says he doesn't have one. But again, Barry who passed away and Jordan. If Barry was here and Jordan was here and you told him you can get Quaaludes, he'd give you $100,000.
Exactly.
For
yeah.
Like, well, just to have them, right? Yeah.
No, I had to take them.
The first thing I would do is I would go to the bathroom and stick my finger down my throat to throw up every bit of food in my you know upper GI. Then I might even take an enema to get rid of the lower GI. I want to be perfectly fuck. I want to be clean. I want to be a pristine condition, like a baby's stomach. And I want to just accept the Quaalude on perfectly clean intestinal tract. Take it. I wait about 6.5 minutes. Then take a shot of hot sake and just sit back and wait and then
is that
pray.
Is that the process?
Yeah, basically. If I felt like I really wanted to get things going, I might jump on a treadmill or a Stairmaster or like, you know,
get the heart rate going.
Yeah, I could do that too as well.
But these were really guys, the excess was so insane. And I've told you some of the stories about Barry, you know, but now it's 2021. You're supposed to be normal and you've grown up. And I mean, how do you look back on that time? And what I wanted to talk about now, because everything that's going on Wall Street right now is pretty insane. Weirdly enough, we have a mutual friend who was kind of at the center of this whole GameStop situation. But how do you view this? And how do you view what I wanted to talk to you about? Because I think some of the shit the hedge funds do is so much worse than some of the things that went to jail for.
Yeah, sure. So like without naming any names, there's, I could talk about Barry, Barry, a lot of the type of shorting that Barry did was not, you know, was that really ruthless type of shorting. The problem with shorting and what you saw happen with GameStop is it's not enough for a short seller to find the stock, analyze it, realize it's wildly overvalued, and short it and wait. That doesn't work because it's very expensive to stay short. Unlike when you buy stock, there's no real cost to capital, so to speak.
And just so everyone knows, when you short a stock,
you're betting it's going down. So if you're short, that means you sold something you don't own, so you have to borrow it. People charge you a fee to borrow their stock. So every day that you're short, it's ticking up. The interest is ticking up and ticking up. So what happens is large hedge funds, what would you do if you got short a stock? What can I do to precipitate the downward move? Well, there are things they could do, like let me call up some friendly journalists and get some really bad articles written about this company, even if the information is true, but they're getting that information out into the public. Some would say that's a public benefit. I strongly doubt that. Other things they'll do is they'll try to get the regulators to start invest. They'll say there's a fraud going on. Maybe there is. And they'll get the regulators to investigate because they need something to happen to drive down the stock. They might even call their other friends who's short and say, hey, check this out. This is a piece of shit. Let's all get behind this. So in the same way, the little guys who are doing that, that's what the big guys do. And
that's why the system is so fucked. I mean, when the pandemic started, Bill Ackman, who's a fucking multi-billionaire.
I remember that one.
Got on CNBC and basically cried and convinced panicked, neurotic Jews like myself that the world economy was basically over. And you better, I don't even know what he wanted us to do, but basically get gold bars and fucking hide in a cave. But he, at the same time was shorting the market and made a fortune. And CNBC basically does advertisements for him. It's like, come on, you're a genius, and tell everybody basically what you want to hear. So where do you stand on, A, I know you're a big guy who's against regulation, but what do you think? Is it just people are responsible? Do your own homework or what?
Well, there's a couple of things. Number one, the SEC is not there to protect the small investor. They're just not. They're there to protect the big institutions. And if you go back to the beginning of the SEC, its first leader was Joseph Kennedy, who shorted the market down and was one of the people responsible for the market crashing in 29. And that culture at the SEC, I don't care what they say, they are not out to protect the little investor. And even if they do sometimes, it's only for the sake of just appearances. There's things they could do that could stop this from happening. They really want to. They could stop this shit cold. They really could. Now, that being said, remember, you know, there's also a fine line. Shorting is a regular, normal, healthy part of the market. So it's not about coming in with a samurai sword and just, you know, carving everything up. You know, brokerage firms are an integral part of the world economy, and they're needed for the movement of money, the application of capital, and for companies to have access to capital. And so they do serve a purpose. The problem is there is Warren Buffett's, and then there's people who are very much the opposite on those big hedge funds, and they're slashing and burning. And shockingly, in the last 5 years, you know, you saw one major, but one guy who was like, just compared to what I did, this person did a million times worse. He got off.
Well, he paid fines.
Paid some fines. Yeah. And got,
I mean, like, you're talking about Steve here.
I don't want to name a name here because I have nothing against the guy. He's probably a really nice guy. Probably a nice guy, by the way. Okay. So it's not that, just that he knew the game and was it whoever he was. He knew the amount of raping and pillaging and insider trading. I knew this from Barry because Barry was involved. It was the level of corruption was so insane at the hedge fund level. It was the whole hedge fund business was based on having these internal analysts and special information trying to get that edge in the market, and they were exploiting all these semi-legal loopholes that on a daily basis they were crossing the line. At the end, nothing happened to them. Even worse, I would say, is The Big Short. I still can't believe at the end of the movie when they have that classic scene and everybody, all the bad guys, they all went to jail. Ha ha, just kidding. No, you remember that scene?
Yes.
And when everyone looked at, oh, that's funny. Yeah, but in our stomachs, I mean, the average person, that's not fair. Like, you know, so that's the issue.
And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand when they see these guys who get off because they pay $250-500 million in fines.
It's $5.
I was gonna say it's not much.
And
right?
They've also done things that have damaged so many more people than the little drug dealer who's doing 20 years in jail. Or Jordan, again, you didn't do great shit. Okay,
The level that these people do on a daily basis.
Right.
Listen, Goldman Sachs, they financed the whole JOLO thing.
Right. So JOLO, explain that, who ended up financing Wolf of Wall Street would not exist without this happening. Correct?
And I heard that the guys at Goldman, they really got hit hard. They reduced the CEO's
explain
bonus.
Explain who JOLO is, though.
So JOLO, we had a number of people wanted to finance the movie. Leo found a group out of Malaysia. Leo had no idea they were illegitimate. How would he possibly? So it's not Leo's fault,
A group out of Malaysia, but they're a group that were in L.A. and in New York and everywhere you turned, they were there.
Leo met these guys, right? And Leo, what would Leo know? It's not his fault. So they turned out that they basically had stolen every dollar directly from the treasury of Malaysia, $3 billion some odd dollars. And they used some of that money to finance the Wolf of Wall Street.
They also donated a bunch of money to the Obama campaign. I mean, they just spread out this money on super high levels.
To not Paris Hilton, to the
they also used it on a lot of hookers, a lot of drugs.
Paris Hilton took a seven, right? Didn't Paris Hilton get a $7 million champagne bathroom, JOLO?
I think she got, you know, $10, $12, $15 million personally for him.
And by the way, Jordan, I want you to keep going, but this guy, Jordan, spent 7 years more in jail than he has.
He hasn't spent a day in jail, right? Or Reza got off, okay? JOLO's counterpart, Reza. Anyway, long story short, all right? What you have is basically a situation like that, right? Where these guys come in, they steal billions. Where did that money come from? How was it allowed to happen? Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs literally created and dealt as a facade and intermediary that allowed them to get away with that. And if you look behind pretty much all the massive crimes out there on Wall Street, Goldman has a finger in them. Now, I'm not saying that Goldman is a criminal institution. I'm not saying that because they're not. They do a lot of amazing things too, but there is a part of Goldman that's fucking evil. All right. And it keeps going and going and going because it is an incestuous relationship between Goldman and the government. All the former treasury secretaries come there, just swapping in and out. And now it's really pretty interesting. It's now starting to be like from big tech and the government. It's now a new thing of they swap back and forth, creating rules that allow them to keep doing what they're doing. Now, moral of the story, Goldman is what happened to Goldman because they got sued, investigated, fined, embarrassed. And I read an article. They reduced the CEO's pay by $10 million this year. That guy, that the impact on that man is literally zero.
To me, the whole tragedy of the system when people talk about what's fair and unfair. The little guy, you got Goldman Sachs, they are able to hire the smartest people in the world, the smartest computer programmers, the smartest stock analysts, and they figure out everything they're doing is a way to get an edge, which is what anyone is supposed to
Nothing
do in their
that.
Business. That's what you're supposed to do. But the little guy who's out there, which was why people were so happy that they sort of crushed it for a minute in GameStop, which we're going to find a lot of people probably got killed.
Well, I was trying to give them as much positive encouragement, but warning them at the same time, because that was obvious that anything that goes up like that with a short squeeze and the value is much, much lower. So one thing about your friend who was a big short seller is they're usually right. They're usually right. When they're that short of stock, they've done deep research and they are typically not going to risk the amount of money that they risk unless they're pretty much sure that the stock is massively overvalued. That being said, once in a blue moon, they're wrong, but that's not even the bigger problem. The problem is timing. Once they get short, the stock's got to drop quickly or else it gets too expensive. That's where the problem starts.
And that's where any capitalist system is. People are going to try to figure out their way of money. So
to bring the audience up to speed, mutual friend of Jordan and Doug's and mine now, I've known him a long time through Doug. He's a short seller, but he writes about it, whether it's a blog or whatever it is, and he's good, and he says something, he moves the needle.
Yeah, I mean, listen, he's a brilliant writer, and he's a brilliant analyst, and the thing now is, though, you know, it used to be, Jordan, 20 years ago, short sellers, they really didn't speak about it. It was kind of like you kept quiet and you didn't do it, but now it's like you say, the networks give this forum where you can get that word out, where some people find that obnoxious or awful, but, you know, there is a very valid purpose to it because there are a lot of frauds out there. There are a lot of fake shit going on the other side. So.
And just overvalued companies that should have both sides played.
Right, but if I had this company and some guy wrote an article, all of a sudden my stock dropped, I would imagine that could be a dangerous line of work, yeah?
You'd
sure. So
people get pissed.
No doubt. So
people get pissed, yeah.
I think, and listen, another aspect of this is that, you know, you have certain companies like Tesla that was shorted heavily. It's a great company, and he was able to fight back because he's Elon Musk. A lot of companies end up getting severely damaged
by short sellers.
Yes, because what happens is once the stock starts to drop like that, it cuts off their access to capital. They can no longer raise money, or if they do, it's way too expensive because the stock is so cheap. They make people think that, you know, the company is not even credit worthy anymore, so they can't get loans.
Some of it becomes self-fulfilling. And
exactly.
Jordan, we're going to have to bring you in because Connolly, he may have some money that wants to come into Action Park Media. Yeah. And just imagine, though, Connolly, someone starts writing that you suck at what you do.
This was going to be my point. So your friend that writes these articles, right? So it's First Amendment. He can write whatever he wants. Maybe it's dangerous. Maybe it's not. And again, just asking. I don't know. I'm asking. Somebody writes, I hate the Entourage movie. It's garbage. You're short selling our movie.
A lot of people wrote that.
You're short selling our movie. Is somebody that writes an article or a review on that any different than somebody that shorts a stock?
No.
Well, the question really is, though, is, okay, who wrote the article, and what do they stand to gain financially by your movie tanking?
That's the difference.
If they don't have a financial interest, let's say it was a movie that was coming out at the same time of yours, and they sabotage your movie, you'd probably have the right to sue that person because they're a biased person acting as an unbiased person, and they're slamming you because they're making money on the other side of that. In the case of just a review who thinks it sucks, well, what are you going to say? Everyone's entitled to their opinion. So there's a very big difference with someone
Skin in the game. So if they have skin in the game, there's money to be made, that's different.
Exactly. Like, for example, with I went out and did this video on supporting the short sellers, and not even just like encouragement. I did not own a share either way, because if I did, it could be construed as I was trying to drive it back
insider
up
trading.
Or down. Yeah, exactly.
So, no, but it's not insider trading. You're allowed to do it.
I'm allowed to, but I didn't even do, I would never have done it because of the inference and the appearance, and then you create problems for yourself. So I think that there's something to be said that if you're really long or short a stock and you write about it, it's, you know, it's questionable.
To me, where the problem lies, and I don't have any solution to it, and then we'll get off of this complicated conversation that's probably better for
it's
a Wall Street show,
though,
but
yeah.
But the thing that bothers me is the networks. They let people come on and they build them up as these geniuses. And if you're just a regular guy sitting at home, you start to listen to those people and you can get hurt. So
the guy you're talking about on CNBC, he rattled me and I don't know anything.
Oh, well, Bill Ackman. Yeah.
Bill Ackman.
Oh,
I was like, what the fuck? That made the rounds. I was going, what the fuck?
But again, you
man?
could judge that as his opinion, or you could judge it as manipulation, whatever it is. But anyway, so with the limited time we have, we'll get back to like conversations, because part of it all comes back to the same thing. Where I grew up, middle class, working class neighborhood where people wanted to make something of themselves, were fighting for money. And how easy was it? Because basically the way I grew up, the way the Entourage guys grew up, and the way you grew up is the same.
Right.
How easy would it have been for them to follow Turtle, E, and Drama to follow Jordan Belfort into Stratton Oakmont and go work there as opposed to following a great actor to Hollywood?
They did. It's very similar. Like, that group was my group, who's from the same areas, same lack of education for most of them, the same aspirations to make it big. And they really were very representative of the typical Stratton broker.
Yeah. And it's sure. it's like how easy is it to get caught up in that? You're 20 years old, you had no money, your parents had no money, and all of a sudden you're making this thing, which the rules are skewed against this guy.
Well, it's even more than that. There's only one scene in The Wolf of Wall Street that I would really wish they wouldn't have put in there, because it gives the wrong impression. When I first went down to that small firm and I walk in the door, it's Leo playing me, and he says, is this stuff legal? Is this regulated? And the guy says, well, no. Let me tell you, I asked that question, and you know what the guy said to me? Of course it is. What do you mean? Look, we're members of the NASD. The stocks trade on the exchange. Of course it's legal. If that guy would have said to me, I would have ran out the door. So the problem is, for a lot of people, is they walk into a place and it looks okay, and they're saying, all right, well, people may, I guess, what's wrong? No, they're not going to say, hey, just so you know, we're breaking the law here. I want you to help us break. They're like, no, oh, this is great. We're helping people. So you got to be really careful, because it could have been a great learning moment for people to see that you don't really know. You have to dig deeper. And sometimes, and I won't deny that, once I got in there, then I started saying, wait a second.
So who do you think out of the Entourage guys would have been the best guy, best broker?
Who's
the
sales?
Oh, E for fucking, yeah, 1,000%.
Come on, Turtle's a great, are you kidding? Turtle with
honestly,
penny stocks?
He was an animal stockbroker. Turtle would have been okay, by the way, especially at the end. Like, there's Turtle, is Fat Turtle or Thin Turtle, right?
Yeah, Turtle
had the biggest metamorphosis of any character. It was like, each you're watching him, like, the pounds melt off every single season as he gets richer. It's like, I guess you're going to be too rich or too thin, right? Turtle, right? But, you know, by the way, even Drama would have been a fucking, all of the guys, except for Vince, too lazy.
Right.
So, Jordan, you were a fan when the show was on? Were you watching?
I've watched every episode at least 10 times. I know every single, almost every line from every episode. My favorite is only, but there's only one thing that is my favorite above all. There was an episode, one of the first episodes, maybe even the first. It was, I think, Turtle who said it. She's top tall. That, to me, was the funniest.
Earth Cafe. It's sick that I remember
Earth
that.
Cafe, Earth Cafe. And he's like, ah, she's top tall. It was just the funniest thing. Because, like, I'd never heard it before. And it was like, I just literally, it struck me as being so funny, coming from Turtle, especially. And it was so ironic. And that was like, it was so layered, the humor, because, like, you're saying that she's not right. Because she's like, did you look in the mirror, Leggy? But then there was some truth to that, because a lot of guys like Leggy. I think the writing, and I'm not just saying
better than the acting.
No, in all seriousness, to me, that series was just like one of the best of all time. And it became, and it's also one of those series that held up as the seasons kept going. It just like, it became like pop culture. All the famous people just wanted to come on the freaking set. And like, I wish I would have been more famous back then, because I would have been on the set.
Oh, would have been a story.
I know. But I was just making my comeback. It was a bit early. I would have been Gatsby. We would have been playing Gatsby. And it would have been Gatsby and Vince, right? Instead of Wolf of Wall Street. But,
Turtle would have left Vince to go work for Wolf of Wall Street. He's like, I got a great opportunity.
Way, that would have been a great.
Yeah. I know. It's a little too early. But I really enjoy. I tell you what, I enjoyed that. And there was so many people. Different time, by the way. When people used to get things each week and they talk about it, the water cooler, right?
Isn't literally it? Water cooler talk.
Yeah.
Well, you couldn't binge it, right? So it was 30 minutes and then you had to wait.
But you know what it was? And when I look back at it, when I hang out with you, it's like just me hanging out with Kevin and Jordan is the same thing as all my high school boys. Of course, we have differences, but it just is that camaraderie, which the show was. That's why, it was before the Me Too movement, but it's irrelevant because it wasn't about that. It was about friendship, loyalty, and lifelong things that lasted.
Doug, you mentioned this about Maya last time we spoke. But
my daughter?
Yeah. It's now like this new generation of people are like discovering the show. And I don't know if that's the pandemic or whatever it is, but you know, I have an 18, 19 year old kids telling me that they've seen every episode. I'm thinking you were four when the show went off the air.
You know what? My daughter is 27 now, I think. Right. And she's really very, you know, politically correct. She grew up in that whole thing and she's very much women's rights. She's educated. She loves the show. Like, she's not offended by the show in the slightest bit.
To be honest with you, I think, just like you were saying earlier about how things have turned, there's always an overcorrection when things happen. Now, again, I think the country usually progresses in the right direction. Hopefully it'll go that way. It's a little unclear right now. It's a little fucked up. But I think there was a crazy overcorrection. And Entourage did. It took the brunt of a lot of shit from a lot of people. And I know it's come back now because, like you said, the amount of negativity that all of Jeremy had to endure over the last couple of years, it's really taken a nice turn. I think this podcast, which Kevin came up with, has really helped that. But you do. You have to have a thick skin. You want to be in this business. Are you going to... I know we talked about possibly doing a television version of The Wolf of Wall Street.
Sure.
A podcast version. Do you want to continue in the Hollywood stuff?
Yeah, what's up?
I don't know. I mean, like, listen, I mean, my business is business. So, I mean, I think I love Hollywood in the sense I think it's fun and great. Who knows? I'd love to make the TV series. There's some issues with the rights still because of Jolo is in hiding.
I was thinking that. I mean, the guy that also, too, that we talked about earlier, Jolo, is on a boat in hiding in international waters where he can't get him. He's been there for 2 years.
It's insane. So that's kind of holding things up right there. But hopefully that will resolve itself sooner rather than later.
And you wrote two other books. There's two other Wolf of Wall Street books.
Exactly. So much material to make the unbelievable series. And I think, though, you know, I look at what happened over the last few years with the Me Too is like, first, it's like it gets this way. Everybody gets painted with that brush. But then over time, they say, OK, who really were the bad people and who kind of got swept up and made mistakes, but made mistakes that given at the time anyone would understand or that they can learn from and they could still go back. And no one wants someone to be locked in jail forever because of things they did. Harvey Weinstein deserves what he got.
Others, he's going to die in jail.
Yeah. And others like did that stuff too. But then there's many other people who, you know, sadly got caught up in hysteria. And hopefully those people, I think they're starting to make their comebacks. I'm seeing it more and more each day. I think that's a good thing.
I would like to see, I guess, the extra books, are they sequels or are they sort of after? Like where do those books fall
Book
into the time?
Book 2 is actually like Godfather 2. It's a before and after.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's written exactly like Godfather 2. I modeled it after God. So it covers what happens after, and it goes back to the early days. It goes back to the
early days. I'll tell you what the brilliant idea is here, Connolly, is the audio podcast of this first. I don't know why Action Park Media hasn't fucking swooped in and bought that, but you should lock that down. But this was, Jordan, this was awesome.
Yeah, this is amazing.
And next time I'm going to talk, I just, you know, one more shout out for Barry Gesser, who is Jordan and I's very close friend who passed away, and we love him and miss him, and we'll get into some great stories, because he honestly, I sold Entourage with a story that happened with Barry and I, and Jordan's stories with him were also very similar. So
I love Barry, and I just say, Barry, he's up there laughing and saying, thank God I wasn't alive, because I would have been so short GameStop.
He would have had a field day with GameStop.
He'd still be arguing it. But I'm right. Remember that with the Chinese RTIC? 100%.
What was that one stock?
The breaks. The Chinese coming. The breaks. Quigley. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. Just last lesson. And by the way, I know nothing about stocks. I know I've seen friends. When you can't let go, it's like gambling.
That's Barry.
Take your losses and walk away. But Barry, we miss him. We love him. And nobody was better and funnier. And Jordan, we're going to have to do this again.
You got it.
For sure. Thank you. thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure, guys.
And wow, that was great. Doug Connolly, yeah. I think we
episode of Victory the Podcast.
Well, the real question, Kevin, is are we going to have an episode that was too intellectually challenging?
We will see. We will let the fans decide.
Victory
the Podcast. I got them just like you today.